Well, thanks very much, Sharon, for a generous introduction. Can I acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation on whose lands we're meeting today and pay respect to their elders past and present, and also acknowledge all First Nations people present today. I've got to say there's something feels very appropriate to giving a lecture in a room where there's a bed just outside the door. I will take no offence if anyone wants to pop out and have a kip partway through, come back for the Q&A at the end. It's a real treat also to be here, hosted by Catherine and by Sharon, and to have so many of you, hard-working public health researchers, giving up a bit of time to listen to a fellow randomister. I also want to pay tribute to Professor David Danks, who established Australia's first Genetics Health Service, which became this institute, and after whom today's seminar is named. As one obituary described him, David was a remarkable doctor, scientist, teacher, mentor, family man, friend, and champion of good causes. I feel like you can't get an obituary much better than that. My focus today is on randomised trials, a central tool in medicine, but underutilised in policy. And in particular, I want to focus on the way in which randomised trials in medicine can upend conventional wisdom, producing results that can improve patient outcomes and extend lifespans. You might call these healthy surprises. Let's start with rapid response teams, set up to prevent cardiac arrests in hospitals. The hypothesis was that if a group of clinical professionals, usually nurses, are on standby to monitor vital signs of patients and intervene before things get bad, then cardiac arrests could be prevented and survival chances increased. It seemed like a sensible and simple idea. Single centre before and after studies showed good outcomes. So rapid response teams were rolled out in hospitals across the United States. A 2005 Australian randomised trial put the idea to the test. 23 hospitals randomised the adoption of rapid response teams. The trial found that there were no discernible differences between the treatment and control groups in terms of the number of cardiac arrests, unplanned ICU admissions, and unplanned deaths. Interesting, however, both treatment and control groups saw a steady reduction in cardiac arrests during the course of the experiment. So it seems that rapid response teams don't work, but that the medical system is steadily getting better at treating that group of patients. Now, like cardiac arrests, many people can increasingly recognise the signs of a stroke. One morning, an American woman by the name of Anita Kramer woke up and couldn't move her left arm. Kramer called 911, and during her evaluation, doctors discovered she had a narrowing in a major blood vessel in the brain. She had an intracranial stent inserted. And then 6 days later, a second stroke left her more disabled than the first. Stenting was first approved by the US Food and Drug Administration in 2005, following a promising study that did not use a control group. The stroke rate in the treatment group was better than expected, so the procedure was approved. Thousands of patients received stents. Then 6 years later, in 2011, the New England Journal of Medicine published the result of a randomised trial. It found that those who got a stent were more than twice as likely to have a stroke in the next month than patients in the control group who were assigned to medical therapy. 5 patients in the treatment group died compared to 1 in the control group. The results were so dramatic that the stenting randomised trial was terminated early. Randomised trials have also shed light on how best to manage patients' blood sugar levels. In 2002, a preliminary, unblinded, single-centre trial found that using insulin to reduce blood sugar levels could improve patient survival in a surgical intensive care unit. The findings were embraced by professional societies who were keen on strict blood sugar targets, and hospitals implemented practices to meet and enforce the standard. Then in 2009, a large 24-site randomised trial with a sample of over 6,000 patients, tested those intensive targets against a less restrictive strategy. That study found that the intensive intervention increased deaths by 2.6 percentage points at 90 days. In practice, that meant that for every 40 patients who received the intensive strategy, one died. Strict blood sugar targets sounded really good in theory, but were harmful in practice. The result was surprising, and hospital practice changed accordingly. Now, like some of you in the room, I've had an appendectomy. In my own case, it was the most pleasant surgical operation I've ever had. I went under anaesthetic with an agonising pain in my abdomen, and when I woke up, it had gone. Since the 1800s, an appendectomy has been the standard treatment for appendicitis. It is the most common emergency surgical procedure in Australia, with around 30,000 appendectomies performed annually. Once upon a time, it was thought that going straight to surgery was the best option. And then four randomised trials compared surgery with a second intervention. Antibiotics as the first option, with surgery reserved for those whose symptoms got worse. In that alternative arm, the antibiotic arm, 65% of patients never got an appendectomy. And much to my surprise, as somebody sporting an appendectomy scar, the studies found that the rate of life-threatening outcomes and time in hospital were the same for the two groups. Antibiotics are also less expensive and less invasive. And no one ever has to cover up their antibiotic scar. Knee and back pain are common conditions, and randomised trials have provided surprises into what works. In the case of treating osteoarthritis of the knee, it was previously common practice for surgeons to either clean out the knee using arthroscopic devices or to inject saline into the knee to irrigate it, a process known as lavage. In 2002, the results of a randomised study showed that those who had either of those two procedures did no better than patients who received sham surgery. Randomised trials have also shown that arthroscopic knee surgery for meniscus tears was no better at reducing pain or increasing function than was physical therapy. Another trial pitted arthroscopic knee surgery for meniscus tears against sham surgery. Much to the surprise of many of the surgeons who had done many, many of these surgeries, sham surgery performed equally well. Another popular surgery for a time involved injecting medical-grade cement into osteoporotic fractures in the spine to treat chronic back pain. Alas, a randomised trial showed that it was ineffective. Randomisation has been used to test the effectiveness of countless other interventions. Along the way, they've disproved many clinical hypotheses. One of the most famous started in the 1880s when US surgeon William Halstead pioneered the approach of treating women with breast cancer with a radical mastectomy, where huge sections of tissue were carved out in the hope of removing the cancer. Halstead convinced others, not by the strength of his data, which was less than solid, but through his persuasive rhetoric and charismatic personality. His extreme self-assurance, possibly intensified by his addiction to cocaine, allowed him to dismiss the critics, and he criticised these critics for their lack of courage. It wasn't until 1981 that a randomised trial in Canada and the United States showed that the radical mastectomy did not reduce mortality when compared to a lumpectomy, which involved removing only the cancerous tissue. From the 1880s to the 1980s, 500,000 women underwent the harm of disfiguring surgeries that did nothing to increase their odds of survival. You don't need to face major surgery or a life-threatening condition to be the beneficiary of insights from randomised trials. Tamiflu is a widely used medication to treat influenza. In a 2014 Cochrane meta-analysis, it was found to only decrease the symptoms from 7 days to 6 days, while at the same time causing nausea and vomiting. It did not prevent virus transmission or reduce hospitalisations. And there was no evidence that Tamiflu reduced deaths. Over the past two decades, governments around the world have spent collectively around $7 billion on Tamiflu stockpiles. The internet coined the term Scammyflu to describe the whole affair. In complementary medicine, randomised trials have shown many widely used interventions to be ineffective. In a review of 10 trials, glucosamine and chondroitin for joint health was found to have no impact on joint pain. Echinacea turned out not to reduce the duration of the common cold. Acupuncture, when tested compared to sham acupuncture, has been found ineffective at reducing pain. Multivitamin randomised trials found no benefits of those multivitamin tablets on survival, on heart disease, or on cancer. Now, not everyone likes surprises, but there's five reasons why it can be beneficial for medical researchers to encounter surprising results. First, surprises promote scientific inquiry. Surprising results often indicate that there's something about the current understanding that might be incomplete or incorrect. This prompts further investigation, leading to a deeper and more accurate understanding of the subject matter. That might involve identifying new risk factors for diseases, uncovering unforeseen side effects of medications, or discovering novel therapeutic targets. Second, surprises encourage open-mindedness. Being surprised by results reminds researchers to not become too entrenched in prevailing theories or expectations. That mindset is crucial for scientific progress, in that it allows for the consideration of alternative explanations and alternative hypotheses. Third, surprises can improve research design. Unexpected outcomes can highlight flaws or limitations in the design of a study, leading researchers to develop more robust methodologies. This can improve the quality of future research, making findings more reliable and generalisable. Fourth, surprises can improve problem-solving skills. Dealing with unexpected results requires creativity and critical thinking, as researchers must figure out why their results deviated from expectations. That can enhance problem-solving skills and lead to more innovative solutions. And fifth, surprises can attract outside interest. Surprising findings can attract attention from the scientific community, the public, and funding bodies. Increased interest can lead to additional resources being allocated to explore new findings further, potentially accelerating scientific progress in the area. They remind us that science and medicine are never perfect and can always be improved. The number of clinical trials has increased over time, along with the number of published authors in the field. More countries and institutions are involved in publishing research. Randomised clinical trials have been embraced across the world. A few years ago, an analysis of cumulative randomised trials published in highly ranked medical journals shows that studies have been published by lead authors in 153 countries. Although most are in the United States, Australia ranks in the top 10. You know this all too well here at the Murdoch Children's Research Institute, where randomised clinical trials are used regularly to work out what works and what doesn't work in children's health. The 21st century is one of improving outcomes through evidence-based medicine, rather than eminence-based medicine. Hundreds of years ago, medicine relied merely on the hope of a good idea, sometimes backed by a confident, cocaine-addicted surgeon, to find and cure the trajectory of a life. 21st century evidence-based medicine relies on hope and rigour in the form of the randomised trial to work out how we can improve outcomes. Across the social sciences, researchers have been using the same idea to test the effectiveness of social policy ideas. In the United States, the Perry Preschool Early Childhood Randomised Experiment began in 1962. The negative income tax experiments, began in 1968. The RAND health insurance experiments began in 1971. The Project STAR class size experiment began in 1985. The Moving to Opportunity housing experiment began in 1994. In 2019, MIT professors Abhijit Banerjee, Esther Duflo and Michael Kremer received the Nobel Prize in Economics for their work applying the method in development economics. In her Nobel Prize lecture, Esther Duflo discussed the example of randomised trials of microcredit programs. These randomised trials demonstrated only modest impacts of microcredit on business formation, largely driven not by people starting their first business, but by existing business owners starting more businesses. Contrary to the claims of microfinance advocates, the randomised trials showed no evidence that microcredit affected spending on education or health, or made women feel more empowered. To those who claimed that microcredit would bring about a radical transformation, this was an unexpected finding. In Australia, randomised trials have shown that drug courts are a cost-effective way of reducing recidivism, that intensive caseworker support for long-term homeless people doesn't increase short-term employment rates, and that home visit programs, nurse home visit programs for pregnant women experiencing adversity have a positive impact, but not quite enough to make them cost-effective. Some of these findings might surprise you, and that too is a good thing. To expand the quantity of randomised policy trials, the Australian Government last year created the Australian Centre for Evaluation. The Australian Centre for Evaluation was established to put evaluation evidence at the heart of policy design and decision making. We seek to improve the volume, the quality and the use of evaluation evidence to support better policy and programs that will improve the lives of Australians. Based in Treasury, the Australian Centre for Evaluation works with agencies across the Commonwealth Government to design and implement trials to answer challenging social and economic policy questions. The Centre's first trials have been developed in collaboration with the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations. They're seeking to understand what works to support people finding jobs. The Centre's ambition goes beyond individual trials to embedding good evaluation principles and practices across government and fostering an evaluative culture that supports continuous learning about what works, why, and for whom. We do it because we believe all Australians should have the best chance in life. We believe that our social and economic programs, just like those in medicine, should evolve over time. Effective interventions should replace ineffective ones. And we can't improve outcomes if we don't know what works. Australians should have effective supports when they're faced with life's challenges, whether that be unemployment or illness. And for that, we need to know which programs and policy settings work and for whom. It requires us to ask hard questions of our own ideas, putting our favourite programs under the microscope and submitting them to rigorous evaluation. That's actually not an easy thing to do, but it's especially vital so we can serve the most vulnerable in our communities, who often rely on government services the most. We can anticipate important results for children, as researchers at the University of Melbourne and at this institute know well. In 2011, I spoke in Parliament about Australia's first randomised trial of an early childhood program, the Early Years Education Program. The program ran from 2011 to 2016. If randomly assigned to the treatment group, children were offered 3 years of tailored education and care. In the control group, children received usual care, a mix of parental and guardian care, as well as the care and education provided by other childhoods and childcare centres or kindergartens. Children in the treatment group had IQ scores that were up to 7 points higher than those in the control group, showed improved resilience, and were less likely than those in the control group to require clinical attention for socio-emotional development. Rigorous evaluation can help children from disadvantaged background start school on an even level with their peers. A couple of years ago, I served as a commissioner on the Global Commission on Evidence to address societal challenges. And our report led to three implementation priorities. First, formalise and strengthen domestic evidence support systems. Conduct or participate in a rapid evidence support system assessment for your country, and find ways to act on the lessons learned if one has not been conducted. Second, enhance and leverage the global evidence architecture. We encourage funders and donors, both in their own countries and those that operate globally, to be part of the solution and encourage impact-oriented evidence producers, especially those producing global public goods in education, in global public goods like living evidence syntheses, to work in more coordinated ways. And third, we urge people to put evidence at the centre of everyday life, to support citizens serving non-government organisations and citizen leaders to take action. And the point of all of these recommendations is that rigorous evaluation is a mindset for which we can all be ambassadors. Each of us can ask the question, how are we collectively using rigorous methods to answer the most important questions in public policy? Now, we know that there's many talented individuals trained in randomised methods across Australia. But we still need to take more opportunities to test big ideas rigorously and to develop the evidence base which improves outcomes. The Australian Centre for Evaluation is creating a platform in government for this, collaborating across the Australian government. In the United Kingdom, a network of 12 What Works centres serve to conduct randomised trials and distill evidence on areas ranging from school education to improving life for older people. The What Works centres are funded by a combination of government and non-government sources, including the Economic and Social Research Council, their equivalent of the Australian Research Council, the Dormant Assets Scheme, and the National Lottery Community Fund. At some point down the track, it's possible to imagine something similar evolving in Australia. But for now, the Australian Centre for Evaluation is the prime agency for conducting randomised policy trials in Australia. Just as ethics review is at the heart of randomised medical trials, so too randomised policy trials conducted by the Australian Centre for Evaluation will be conducted within a rigorous ethical framework. Building that trust is vital as we work to expand the quality and quantity of policy evaluation across Australia. It's vital that evaluations are conducted ethically, carefully, and transparently. Alongside the production of evidence, the Australian Centre for Evaluation is working to improve the use of evidence, encouraging the use of high-quality evaluations over low-quality evaluations and meta-analyses over single studies. So in conclusion, thank you for the work you do to improve the evidence base on what works. In policy, as in medicine, it's healthy to be surprised, and it can help us shape a better world.